think it was Gary Snyder said that it, if you travel someplace and it takes you a day to get there in your car, that's only your body that's gotten there. It'll take another couple of days for your mind to get there. I find even driving across town seems like that's kind of true. So it'll take a minute to get here. Okay, we recording? All right. So I have a lot of notes for a change. I don't know how far we'll get, but that's okay because I'll be back in a week. And I wanted to start with two images, and then I want to do kind of a recap of some of the things I talked about in the last couple of weeks and check in with everybody, see if we have questions about things. But also the recap fits into the image. So the first image is that often the Buddha Dharma as a teaching is symbolically represented by a wheel. You've all seen that. And that wheel shows up in a lot of different sort of situations. Like if you go to temples, you'll see a Dharma wheel with eight spokes, usually golden colored. Two deer on the side. The deer come from Deer Park, where Buddha did some of his teaching. The thing about a wheel is that the spokes of a wheel connect in the rim, not in a linear fashion. I mean, it's a whole. All the eight spokes connect with the wheel equally. There's no first spoke or last spoke. And that's kind of interesting because in the Dharma teachings of the 12 links of dependent origination, the links are kind of laid out sequentially, starting with ignorance and working your way through old age and death and so on and so forth. And we think in a linear fashion. In fact, if you ask Americans about the past, they'll say it's over there on the left. And if you ask them about the future, they'll say it's over there on the right. If you ask Muslims, they'll do the reverse. And that's because English is written from left to right, and Arabic is written from right to left. And of course, then the Chinese write from top to bottom. At least they used to. They don't anymore. But traditionally, they wrote from top to bottom. So that's all interesting. But the point is that it's a linear way of thinking about things. This to this to this to this to this. But if you think about the Dharma, especially at the time of the Buddha, it wasn't linear. In fact, at the Buddha's time, the wheel was, in human history anyway, a fairly new invention. I mean, it's true that the Buddha talks about the track of the wheel and that sort of thing. But the wheel itself is something that everything connects to everything all at the same time. You can't really start in one place very easily and work your way to another place. And if you think about the Buddha Dharma as a teaching, that sort of gives another perspective on it, because we always get the teaching in a kind of linear fashion. And the teacher starts talking and does a logical progression to put things together. But when you think about what's being put together, all the pieces actually fit together in one whole, without any beginning or end, and everything explains everything else. And it can be sort of confusing, actually, from that point of view. When I did some Nagarjuna translating, I decided to use the term limb instead of 12 links to emphasize that. My fellow scholars got very exercised about that and very unhappy. But I was really trying to make a point. And actually, the original sense can sort of be translated both ways. But the material that I've been talking about over the last couple of meetings that I'll be talking about today and next week is not linear, even though I present it that way. So somehow we need to try and get all these pieces together. Now the other image that I have is when Kay and I got in the car to come over here today, we turned on the radio, and there was J.S. Bach beautifully we thought it was one of the Brandenburg concertos. It was something else, but that doesn't matter. And I was listening to the piece, and there are all these complex threads of things coming in and out and going together and so on and so forth. And then toward the very end, it all came together in a coda, and there was this big aha at the very end. Because all this complex pattern resolved itself into one auditory image, if you will. And there it was, boom, you know, it was beautiful. And the Dharma can be like that also. You know, there are these all these threads that are moving around. And as you learn about the Dharma, and you start seeing how all these threads begin to piece together, this pattern begins to unfold. And the pattern takes over, and the individual threads are somehow less important than getting the larger pattern. And you get it, and it'll click and go, bow, just like that. There's a book out called The Dalai Lama at Harvard. And I happened to be really fortunate. I was living in Massachusetts when he was at Harvard teaching, and so I was at that teaching. And that was the way he taught. He had this extraordinarily complex pattern that he was trying to weave together over some period of time. It was very hard to follow, but I was being very attentive, and I was younger at the time, so I could be more attentive more successfully. And he finally pulled it all together at the end, and it was like, oh, wow, fantastic, you know. And I think you could probably get that if you tried reading the book. I haven't tried reading the book in a lot of years, but I would think it's there. So that's a different way to approach Dharma teachings than we usually think of. So if you keep that in mind, and I will try and create a pattern, and I'm going to try and pull some of that pattern together today and next week. I'm not going to do it the way the Dalai Lama does it. There's no possibility. There's not going to be any great aha. In fact, I feel a little, what do I want to say? Insecure or shy about what I'm doing, because in preparation for this, I was reading this book called Meditation on the Nature of Mind, which were some of it in lectures that the Dalai Lama did at UC Santa Barbara a number of years ago. And I thought, I don't know anything. What am I doing coming to Thubten Norbulang and talking about this material? I mean, it, you know, I was really feeling like, oh, geez. But on the other hand, every morning I do Bodhisattva vows. So here I am, because I said every morning, I said I'm going to be here in one way or another. Okay, the recap. So there were several key points that I made over the last couple of weeks, and I'm going to iterate them. And if there's anything that I need to go back over before we go forward, please tell me that there's something you don't understand or that you would like clarified. So the first thing that, maybe not the first thing, but one of the things I was talking about was that in the 24-hour cycle, we go through three stages of consciousness: waking stage, dreaming stage, and deep sleep stage, which have certain characteristics. And in Vajrayana practice or in tantric practice, those are taken to be similitudes or something similar to the three bodies of the Buddha: the Dharmakaya, the Sambhogakaya, the Nirmanakaya, or death, the in-between state, and rebirth. These things are all similar to each other in certain ways, although of course they're very different. When we go to sleep and we're not dreaming, we're not dead, usually. But there is a similarity between the clear light mind, which arises just at the moment before death, and deep sleep, which is a unitary state. There is no consciousness of diversity. It's a unitary state. So we're good about those things? Yeah? Okay. The other thing that I talked about that to me has always been very important is consciousness is supported by energy. It's called winds. We have these inner energies in the body, and as the mind moves, the winds move, or better to say that the winds actually carry the mind. And that no concept, no thought, no state of consciousness can occur without a corresponding inner state of energy. And the metaphor that the Tibetans use for this is a horse and rider. The horse is like the winds, and the rider is like the consciousness or mind. And so the winds carry the mind forward, but where the mind, where the winds go is determined by the thoughts or the state of consciousness. Okay? So we're good about that one. And that's also, that's very important for understanding Vajrayana practice. And finally, the last thing that I talked about was what's called the wisdom mind of bliss voidness. And this is where Madhyamaka sort of enters the picture from the point of view of thinking about things, or a more analytic point of view, rather than from the point of view of actual experience. So Madhyamaka, as a system of thought, is all about understanding, on the one hand, that things are not the way they appear, that there's an underlying reality which is in a certain way different than the way things appear. Things appear solid, they appear unitary, they appear to carry their own characteristics, when in fact, if we use our analytic minds, we recognize that nothing is really solid. I mean, this table, of course, is composed of bits of wood which are composed of molecules, and if you're really into the physics of it, it goes down to the point where we're not even talking about stuff anymore. We're talking about probabilities of maybe a probabilistic electron will be in a certain location, but we can't be entirely sure when, because we can't identify location and time both. So it kind of goes down to this level of you can't find anything, which is very Madhyamaka, because when you start analyzing, the way things appear begin to recede. Similarly, in Madhyamaka, we see things as unbounded in time. We don't see that everything arises in dependence on causes and conditions and has necessary outcomes. We just see it sort of flopping there, like these pages, these paper just sort of sitting here. But what we don't see is what Thich Nhat Hanh refers to as, do you see the cloud in the paper? Because, of course, the cloud produced the rain, which was absorbed by the tree that kept the tree alive, and et cetera, et cetera, so that we have paper. But we don't see the cloud in the paper. Nor do we see where the paper is going, by the way, which pretty much accounts for the entire ecological problem of the human race, is we don't see where things are going. It's, throw it in the ground, throw it in the ocean, who cares? We can't see it, it's disappearing, you know. It doesn't disappear. But and then the last thing, and from the point of view of what we're talking about, everything seems to have characteristics of its own. Like, you know, paper is flat, it's white, and so on and so forth. But if you actually begin to analyze the process of cognition, you realize that all the characteristics that are being apparently there in what you're looking at are actually coming from your side. You know, we attribute meaning, value, and a lot of other things to the piece of paper, including the fact that it's just sitting there when in fact we just got through saying it's composed of parts and particles that depends upon clouds and so on and so forth. We don't experience any of that kind of stuff. Okay, so that's the basic Madhyamaka view in a nutshell. Where it becomes relevant is when you apply it to your own mind or consciousness. I mean, from an ecological point of view, it's obviously relevant when you apply it to what's going on in the world. But from the point of view of the Buddhist enterprise, which is about achieving liberation and enlightenment on the one hand, and taking care of everyone and everything around you, When you think about it in the context of liberation, for example, then applying it to the mind is what becomes very important. Applying it to consciousness or perception becomes very important. Not so much what's actually going on in the world. So the last thing that I mentioned, and then I'm going to loop back to talking about the mind. The last thing that I mentioned in the course of this process was that Vajrayana or Tantra, I will use these terms interchangeably, from my point of view, is a technique for accessing what might be called the subconscious or the unconscious mind. I mean, Lamrim, for example, is a great system for starting with the conscious mind, making decisions, taking vows, understanding cause and effect, setting intention, and so on and so forth. And there's a way in which it affects the unconscious mind, but it doesn't directly get into the unconscious mind. Tantra directly gets into the unconscious mind and begins to work with it. Now, of course, the problem, as a sort of scholar in saying something like that, is the unconscious mind is unconscious, right? So what do we know about it? Well, by definition, we don't know anything about it. There's a lot of mystery to what's going on in the unconscious mind. So when the lamas and the tradition say, if you do such and such a practice, it's going to affect your mind in such and such a way, there's a kind of, you're going on faith, right? Because until you do the practice for a long period of time, you start seeing things change, you don't really know what's going on because the unconscious mind is unconscious, right? And it's not the only thing that ends up being actually a fairly serious mystery in the Buddha Dharma. When we talk about the clear light or the clear light of death, and I will talk much more about this next week, we're talking about something that's very mysterious. And why is it mysterious? It's mysterious because it's what underlies both the conscious and the unconscious mind. So if the unconscious mind was sort of unknowable, this is deeply unknowable. And yet it is the key in the process of becoming a Buddha. As Taratulku once said, and I hope I can paraphrase him correctly, that it's upon the basis of the clear light mind that we practice and become Buddhas. That's a pretty definitive statement, okay? But that means it's on the basis of something that's mysterious and somewhat unknowable. Because we all die, and within the context of Buddhism, we've died many times, but we don't know anything about this mind because we, boom, zip by it so quickly. But I'll talk about this some more next week also. Well, it's a
teaser.
Yeah, it's the teaser, but it's a complex subject in itself. And anyway, I want to save it for the last talk that I do because I'm going to say some things that are probably fairly heretical, and you might not want me back afterwards. So now that's the real teaser, right? Okay. Heresy. Oh man. Okay. Now then. What?
You're sure looking to roll the crowds in, aren't you?
I don't have anything to lose.
David with heresy next week.
Maybe the audience will increase or decrease. Or decrease. Okay, so we've been talking about mind. And let me talk about mind in a little bit more specific way. The Buddha excelled at teaching on the basis of what we're already experiencing and what we already, in a certain sense, know, what's there before us. He didn't start off his teaching with a lot of abstract concepts. He didn't talk about revelation, like, wow, I had this revelation and this is the way things are and this is what you should do. But he started in a very concrete kind of way. And one of the concrete ways that he started was talking about the nature of mind and consciousness. And he started by talking about the sense organs. And now, you know, if you go back to Buddha's time, you know, most people didn't really think about the way the perceptual process worked. They just lived in what they took to be reality. I mean, the coconut palms are right there. They're just coconut palms, no big deal. Everybody experiences those things. And he said, well, that's not quite what's going on. What's going on is you have eyes, and by the way, if you close your eyes, you can't see the coconut palms anymore, right? So your awareness is dependent upon a sense organ. So there's an object out there, there's a sense organ, And there's an awareness, and those three things come together and you have a visual consciousness. That's what's actually going on. You're not experiencing a coconut palm, you're experiencing a visual awareness. That was a radical thing for 2,500 years ago for most people. The same thing goes for all of the other material sense organs. When you hear a sound, and we know that because we're sophisticated moderns and we're all educated, that your ear is responding to vibrations in the air, and there's an awareness that's associated with that. And when I'm hearing Bach, when I turn on my car radio in the morning to come here, or the afternoon to come here, it's not really that the sound is out there and I'm experiencing that. I'm experiencing an internal process, and I attribute it to being out there, which doesn't mean there isn't anything out there. The Buddha didn't say there's nothing out there. He just said that what you're experiencing is your experience, not so much that. Which, by the way, is an important point, because there are philosophical schools that are called idealists who say there's nothing out there, it's merely your mind. There's just nothing else out there at all. And in fact, there are some schools of thought in Buddhism that take that point of view. Madhyamaka is not one of them. It insists there's something out there, which is not really knowable in itself. This isn't a Madhyamaka class. Come to Don's class. He'll talk about that stuff. He's doing the fundamental stanzas on Wednesday, I guess it is, isn't it? Wednesday, yeah. Okay. Now, where this gets really interesting is when we talk about mind or consciousness. Because we're sitting around here and we have thoughts in our noggin, we say in our noggin. In the ancient world, they would have said in our heart, not in our head. But anyway, that's interesting in itself, but it's a side point. Okay, what is going on here? The Buddha taught that actually there are not five senses, but there are six senses. One of them is non-material, and it's called mind. What could that mean to have mind as a sense organ, or as a sense experience, rather than as whatever we tend to think of it as being, as modern people? Well, for one thing, what is the sense organ that's associated with mind or thoughts? Now, if I ask anybody in this room, so I will, I'll ask Charmaine since she's a likely candidate, what's the sense organ that's associated with thought?
The brain.
Right. We would all say the brain, but Buddhists would not. They would say that the sense organ that's associated with thought is the previous moment of consciousness. That it's a non-material sense organ. That when I have a thought, it exists in dependence on the previous moment of my mind stream or the previous moment of thought. And what are the implications of this? They're really fairly profound, okay? And I'm not going to go into all of them, but if you apply Madhyamaka to this way of thinking about things, and when we took this routine of everything is dependent on parts and particles, it's made up of parts and particles, it's dependent upon, everything arises dependently and it exists based upon designation or attribution. If you apply that to your own process of thinking and your own process of awareness, some really interesting stuff starts to happen. For one thing, the process begins to decompose because your awareness becomes aware of something that's going on, and it's no longer the case that I am thinking, but rather thinking is happening and observing of the thinking is happening, and I might have the thought that I am the one that's doing the observing. But you begin to see that whole process when you apply this way of reasoning to the natural flow of thoughts and the natural flow of awareness. Okay, so this is the important framework to begin now to understand all of the other stuff that I've been talking about, right? Because it's a very different way of understanding mind and consciousness. Absolutely not the way we natively understand it. Now think about applying this then to things like clear light mind, or the internal energies, or anything else. Now, there's some place where His Holiness wrote, and I can never find this quote, but I know for sure he said it, that the fastest progress on the path is made by applying this analytic view to the nature of mind. If you want to make real progress on the path to liberation and enlightenment, then examine the nature of your mind in the context of Madhyamaka philosophy, because everything begins to shift and change. So I'm going to read something from this book called Meditation on the Nature of Mind, how appropriate, by His Holiness. And he talks about this in the context of middle way philosophy. So bear with me. Excuse me, in the context of middle way philosophy and Tantra. He says, the Tantra in general explains that one generates the meditational deity out of the realization of emptiness. This is true in all four classes of Tantra: action Tantra, performance Tantra, yoga Tantra, and highest yoga Tantra. But in highest yoga Tantra, the mind that realizes emptiness is special. So when we're talking about the mind that realizes emptiness here, we're talking about applying this understanding of emptiness to our own mind or consciousness in the way in which I've been talking about it. Not as dependent on the brain, but as dependent on previous moments of consciousness as a mind stream. That's the term that's used. But here is where this loops back to Tantra. In highest yoga Tantra, the mind that realizes emptiness is special. That's the fourth of the four categories of tantric practice. It is not a rough, ordinary mind, which is to say, a rough, ordinary mind is the mind that we all have right now. He's talking about a subtler level of mind, right? So rough, ordinary mind would be like waking consciousness. A subtler mind would be like dreaming state consciousness. A still subtler state of mind would be like deep sleep consciousness. And remember I said probably in the beginning of December, from the Buddhist point of view, when we're asleep and not dreaming, we are not unconscious, but we're conscious of nothing, because consciousness is a stream that never ends, right? And in fact, modern neuroscientific research would support that, because we're generating brainwaves even when we're not dreaming. How could we be generating brainwaves if the mind wasn't active? Now, of course, there's the whole problem of the relationship of mind and brain. But let's set that aside and just say there is some evidence that something is going on even when we're in dreamless sleep. So that's the non-rough mind that he's talking about. Hold on. It is not a rough, ordinary mind. Instead, when one practices highest yoga tantra, one should possess a strong conviction that this mind, the mind out of which the deity is generated, is a primordial innate mind of clear light. So when we're practicing anything, even whether it's the lower tantras, when you're visualizing Tara, or you're visualizing Vajrayogini or Guhya Samaja, it's all the same. It comes out of the mind that understands its own emptiness. There are places in the sadhana where you'll hear over and over again, everything is emptiness, everything is void. Out of the voidness arises often a lotus, a moon seed, or whatever. But it's always coming out of emptiness. It means it's coming out of the realization of the empty nature of the mind. Pops out. Okay. To have such conviction, and I want to talk about conviction in a bit, to have such conviction, it is not enough to simply recite some words as part of a ritual. Rather, one must make the clear light appear within the mind, and with a conviction that it is this primordial innate mind that is realizing emptiness, one achieves calm abiding and insight. Hence, the process of generating the deity out of emptiness is quite different in the lower tantras than in the highest yoga tantra. In highest yoga tantra, one generates the deity out of the primordial innate mind of clear light. But that also means, although he doesn't say this, in the three lower tantras, you don't have to have that level of achievement to practice. Because if you did, nobody would be practicing anything. Because to achieve the clear light mind is not easy. Although you could practice with a similitude of it, and that's a whole other kind of issue. But the point I want to make, because here at Thubten Norbu Ling, there are a lot of practices that go on a regular basis that are not highest yoga tantra practices. They're in the three lower categories. And lower doesn't mean like lesser, it's just the way they organize things, okay? But the deity, Tara, or the Yidam is the word I tend to prefer, which means made of mind, that's Yidam, means Yid, mind, means mind made, comes out of the mind, and that's very important, right? So when you're practicing, it's not just like, okay, I'm going to imagine Tara over here, and then, yeah, there she is, and now she's showering blessings on me. It's much more like, that's my mind in the form of Tara. And that's a very hard achievement for Westerners to really believe it deeply. That is my mind in the form of Tara, in the form of compassion that I am working with, external to myself. Okay, but that conviction is absolutely essential to have a really successful and profound practice. Or tea. When one reaches the dzogrim or completion stage of highest yoga tantra, one additionally resorts to practices involving the manipulation of the energy and drops within the channels of the subtle body. Those are the energies I was talking about, the horse upon which the mind is the rider. As a result of this practice, the grosser levels of mind wane or dissolve. As the rougher ordinary mind energies become inactive, the subtler ones become active. So what he's saying is, as you practice, your waking state consciousness becomes more quiescent, and really successful practice of any of the tantras means actually entering into a state of mind that's more like the dream state. It's subtler. And if you practice really deeply, it's almost like entering into the dreamless sleep state. In fact, to practice highest yoga tantra really successfully, that's pretty much what you have to do. Enter the state that's beyond dream, that's like dreamless sleep. Now, it's a similitude again, but it's the only thing that we're familiar with and that we understand. Okay, am I losing people here? I'm starting to see some blank faces. No, it's just, this is difficult material, so maybe that's part of what's happening. Okay, one other quotation. In Tantra, it is as if something's own essence were manifesting as its own realization. This can only take place when one takes the ultimate nature of mind as one's object, culminating in an indivisibility of awareness and emptiness. That is why the Indian master Aryadeva states that it is extremely important to realize the ultimate nature or reality of the mind. For it is the mind that is the root of samsara and nirvana, right? So if you want out, if you want liberation, okay, this is the mechanism, to use that kind of term. Of course, Buddhists would never use that term, mechanism. But anyway, it's the means, which is the mind generates out of itself, itself, and contemplates itself. The mind contemplates itself. Now, the ultimate version of that is as you go through meditating on the similitude of the death process through the eight stages of dissolution, you come to the clear light mind, which is what exists just before you pop into the bardo or into the next life or into the deep sleep, whatever you want to believe in. It's the last stage, that clear light mind. And the ultimate practice for the yogis is at that point, when people appear clinically dead, is for the awareness, which is the same awareness as exists in deep dreamless sleep, for that awareness to contemplate itself. That's what he meant when he said, something seems to arise out of something else. Shall I read that quote again? What was that?
Sure. Yeah.
Let's see if I can find it again. I took the bookmark out.
You're asking if you wanted to read us His Holiness's words. Yes, please, David.
He says it much better than I could. Okay, here it is. In Tantra, it is as if something's own essence were manifesting as its own realization. As if something's own essence were manifesting as its own realization. That means that the clear light mind meditates upon itself as bliss voidness, and that's the realization. That's the ultimate realization. And in fact, that's Buddhahood, if that makes any sense at all. Okay. So that's the goal of tantric, of Vajrayana practice, and everything builds up to that goal. Okay. Whether it's the highest yoga tantras or the lowest tantras, they all integrally work toward that direction. Now, I have to say, though, along the way, there are other things that happen, such as developing bodhicitta. So I'm speaking mostly from the point of view of wisdom practice. But along the way, bodhicitta develops also. And there are many ways of understanding bodhicitta. So I don't want to make it sound like, oh, this is sort of a side issue. It's very important. But it develops along the way, and I'm focusing more on the tradition, on the wisdom tradition. This is within the context, what I've been speaking of is within the context of highest yoga tantra. Within the other tantras, we're practicing with an image that appears to be outside of us. Okay. Now, the title of this talk is Madhyamaka and Tantra. So the Madhyamaka point of view of understanding what's going on in the practice is that when we're practicing with the appearance of our mind as external to ourselves, we remember that it is our own mind, okay? And we apply all of the logical reasoning to that sense of the qualities of compassion as Avalokiteshvara, or compassion as Tara, or purification of vows as Tara. We apply that understanding throughout the process of practice, so that at every moment as we're practicing, we're understanding that what we visualize as being external to us is in fact not external to us. That it is our own mind, and just like the rest of the world, it is actually just us. Okay. So I feel like I'm kind of beating this horse to death here. But it's kind of a key point. Because it's very easy. Well, it's not. I'm approaching it the wrong way. Doing visualization practices are difficult enough in themselves to do successfully, because you want to achieve very clear appearance of the Yidam or the deity. And there's a lot of sort of dramatic activity in the sadhana. So keeping all of that going is difficult enough in itself. But the other layer that really needs to be added on to it is the Madhyamaka layer, because that's the underpinning of all of the Vajrayana practice. Because otherwise, it's very easy to get into dealing with the question of, is this real? Is this not real? Is this outside of myself? Is it inside of myself? Madhyamaka answers that by saying, it's actually neither inside of you nor outside of you. It's not actually there, but it's not actually not there. Because your mind is both exactly as it appears, conventionally speaking, but ultimately speaking, you got it all wrong. It's absolutely not what it appears to be. Because if it goes back to the 12 limbs or 12 links of dependent origination, the very first link is ignorance, which is to say, everything that we think about what's going on around us is wrong. I mean, that's kind of a radical thing for any religion to say, that the place where you start is you're completely confused, you have no idea what's going on, and everything you think about, everything, is wrong.
Good luck.
Good luck, right? On the other hand, I consider it kind of an improvement over original sin, because you can't get away from original sin, but there is an antidote to ignorance and delusion, and it's called wisdom. And everybody can achieve it. You just go through the process. If you have enough mind, you go through the process and you can get out from under the problem. And in fact, that is the Buddhist enterprise. So when you're practicing, you apply all this Madhyamaka thought to what you're doing at the same time as you're doing all this visualization. And that's the critical thing, because Tara may be compassion, but her nature is emptiness. And her nature is bliss emptiness. Not mere emptiness, but bliss emptiness. The practice of achieving bliss is associated with moving the winds. When the Dalai Lama was talking about the winds and the channels and the drops, that's really the highest yoga tantra practice for achieving bliss. But as I said at the very beginning of this process, I would talk about my own experience in talking about tantra. And what my experience is that doing all these practices, because we're creating a certain kind of mind with certain kinds of images, bliss naturally arises. So that it's not the case that the practice is dry and it's difficult, but it actually becomes beatific. Because the farther you go into the practice, the more wonderful it gets, the more blissful it gets, the more enjoyable it gets. And it should be enjoyable. Because if it's not, that's the time to stop and come back the next day. One of the things that one of my teachers, Choje Rinpoche, said in regards to practice in general is that you should always stop practicing when everything is good. If you get to the point where things aren't good in your practice and it's difficult, you won't want to come back to the practice in the future. But if you stop practicing where everything's wonderful, it's like, okay, I want to do that again, you know. You'll want to come back to it again. And it's like exercise that way. If you exercise to the point of flat exhaustion, you don't want to go back to the gym. But if you exercise to the point where the endorphins are running, that's pretty cool. Now I want to come back again. Okay. All right. So that's it for today. And that's the reason I only wanted to have a 1 hour talk, because I knew that this was not going to go for 90 minutes. But that leaves us 15 minutes for dialogue and conversation, which is what we were supposed to be doing all along, but it's been a lot of my talk, you listen. Yes?
So is conviction going to come up next time, or is there some more you're going to say about conviction?
Conviction? Well, let me say something about the role of conviction now. In the beginning, I think it's really difficult for Americans, for Westerners generally, I think that in the very beginning, it's very difficult to take any of the yidams or deities as if they're real, that there's a real Tara. I think that that's really very difficult. I think that we sort of practice sort of believing it and maybe sort of not believing it. Like maybe it's true and maybe it's not true. That's in the beginning anyway. Now, if we get really lucky in our practice and Tara literally appears to us, then that changes. But it takes a lot of effort to go from point A to point B where Tara actually appears. And it's kind of like, oh, yeah. I'm not making this up. This Tara is something real. So we have to convince ourselves somehow that Tara is real in order to practice successfully. And I think that the analytic process, although it sounds strange, it's again speaking from my own experience, not like some great Buddhist master, I think that the analytic process comes into play here. Because we can look at our own dreams, and if we look at our own dreams and various experiences we've had, I think Tara has appeared in our dreams, but she doesn't always look green, for example. She appears in other forms. And that quality of sweet caring and concern has appeared in our dreams. I mean, if nothing else, you can take the all-mother sentient beings paths. You know, we've had so many mothers in various lives over and over again. They've been so sweet and tender and taking care of us. I don't know if that's a good path to follow, as the lamas discovered when they first started teaching in the United States. And they'd say, well, you know, you just you practice compassion and you understand compassion just in the way your mother was sweet and kind and compassionate to you. And the American audience look at them and say, not my mother. And the Tibetans would say, what? You had a mother that wasn't? But some of us had mothers that were, or at least at moments were. But for myself, I think dream is the place to go to achieve conviction for certain things. Of course, we wake up and we say it was only a dream. But that's because we discount dreams. But we don't have to discount dreams. In fact, if you want to find out how important dreams are and the things that occur in dreams are, to mangle my language, try sleeping for 2 hours a night for a week. And you'll find out. I have a lot of experience of that, unfortunately. You'll find out how important dreams really are. And people go crazy when they can't dream, in fact. I mean, there are studies of this. And one of the ways in which, this will be kind of a weird sidebar, but one of the ways in which the CIA tortures people is they check out the rapid eye movement and they wake them up as soon as they see the rapid eye movement so they can't dream. And it drives people nuts and makes them compliant. So dream is a really positive source of conviction, is what I'm trying to get at through that bizarre metaphor. Okay, let's leave the CIA out of this. Anything else?
Of course, I have a question.
Of course.
So for me, I'm always trying to describe as accurately as I can the relationship between the yidam, the guru, and yourself and your mind when you're doing Guru Devi yoga practice. So what is appearing and how does it appear when you're visualizing Tara as inseparable from the Guru, as a manifestation of the emptiness of your own wisdom, but also where's Tara? What's Tara?
Okay, I'm going to have to shift into Madhyamaka to answer this question. Okay, the
and
question...
I'm going to shamelessly copy this for Tuesday nights. Is it okay?
Of course.
Okay.
Everything connects to everything, remember? That's okay. I'll post this recording pretty quickly. Will I get it posted before Tuesday? Yeah. I'll get it posted before Tuesday. I did talk about the guru in December. But let's go back to this. This is sort of what I was going to get into next week, but I'll get into it now. If we apply Madhyamaka logic to anything, what we end up with is the inability to assert that anything either exists or does not exist. I mean, in Western Aristotelian logic, the proposition is that something is either A or not A. And on that basis, all logic is built. Now, the Buddhists took over Aristotelian logic, and they didn't really feel that that was an adequate description of the possibilities. They said, what about both A and not A? Or what about neither A nor not A? So this is the four-corner logic of Buddhism. Without going into this really deeply, the main point is that if you really analyze anything deeply, what you find is you can't really assert that anything about it either exists or does not exist. You can't really say the paper is here, but you can't say it's not here. The reason that you can't say the paper is here is when you look at it really closely, it breaks apart into parts. And the qualities that are associated with paper appear to be coming from your own mind pretty clearly. That's the difference between paper and a rug. I mean, they're both flat things that stuff sits on, whether it's ink or tables, you know. And they're only temporarily here. Everything is transitory. I mean, this paper, as we discussed, used to be a tree, and it's on its way to I have no idea what. But it's only in this apparent moment that we have paper. And yet there is the paper, right? So it both appears to exist, even though it appears not to exist when we analyze it. And we can't say either of those propositions are ultimately true. Because if we go to the level of saying there's no paper there, well, that's clearly wrong, because here it is. And yet if I say the paper is really there, it doesn't take very much for that to happen, and then the paper's not there, okay? So we can't say either. Now, if we apply that to the guru, the yidam, the state of consciousness, and so on and so forth, can we say absolutely that there's a difference between the guru's mind and my own mind? To say that there's a difference between the guru's mind and my own mind is to say they're absolutely different from each other. We can't assert that proposition finally, because when we look at my mind and we look at the guru's mind, assuming we can do that, and we analyze them deeply, 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 where we end up is what the Buddhists say is it's all of the same taste. They won't say it's the same thing, subject of next week. They'll say it's of the same taste because it has apparently the same characteristics, except we know from Madhyamaka that the characteristics are imputed. They're not actually there. So you can't see the guru's mind as the same as mine, but you can't see the guru's mind as different than mine, ultimately speaking. Conventionally, of course, it's true, all right? Conventionally speaking, at the moment, Denma Lhotse Rinpoche is a four-year-old child in Sikkim. And yet, is his mind really different than mine? Conventionally, of course. Ultimately speaking, not. Okay. Now, it's the ultimately speaking upon which we practice guru yoga, which is where we find that my mind and the guru's mind meet. Okay. Now, how is it that they have the same taste? They have the same taste because they're all empty or devoid of the characteristics we impute on them. That's the way in which they're the same. So what else comes out of emptiness? The Dalai Lama told us. The yidam emerges out of emptiness in the practice because it's our own mind taking the form of Tara, right? So it's also the guru's mind taking the form of Tara. So if there's no difference ultimately between my mind and the guru's mind, there's no difference between my mind as Tara and the guru's mind as Tara. So that's the basis upon which we practice. Did that answer the question?
I think so, because you had read a passage where His Holiness was saying that when you to practice really effectively a high Tathagata, then you want to practice with the mind where the yidam is emerging from emptiness. So it sounds to me though like that's an instruction to practice with dependent arising, because that's the only way that you're going to see the yidam.
That's one way. One way to see the yidam is to practice in the sense of dependent arising. But I think personally the more powerful way is to practice on the basis of having examined your own mind and recognized that your own mind has an utterly different characteristic than you see it at the moment, the rough mind, that the actual nature of the mind is its beatific, blissful, empty nature. Mm-hmm. And that's, Tara arises out of that. Tara doesn't actually arise out of what His Holiness called the rough mind of everyday consciousness. Right.
It arises out of the Dharmakaya wisdom mind. But then it takes
yes.
the form of Tara. And
yes.
that taking the form of Tara versus Yamataka, for example, is a function of dependent arising.
It's a function of dependent arising in the sense of it's your intention that it will take a certain form.
Okay.
It is. I mean, intention becomes, the arising is dependent upon the intention that it will be this versus it will be that.
But this is the conviction piece, and this is also the motivational piece.
Yes.
If you can wish it and you can imagine it, then you're creating the causes for that to dependently arise in that form.
Thank you. And that gets to Alexa's question.
I'm just saying that it's this idea that everything exists on the tip of a wish, almost, which is what Lama Zopa Rinpoche always says.
Uh-huh.
That if you can wish it, if you can imagine it or dream it, then you can create the cause for it to dependently arise in that form. And then, so having conviction that your mind has this amazing emptiness, that it is, that the deity, you can work with your mind in the form of the deity that arises out of your Dharmakaya wisdom mind, is, I don't know, the name of the game?
Yes, it's the name of the game. Yes.
So something that's been happening, a phenomenon that's been happening to me recently, is something similar to this, but it's not related the Dharma, except for, you know, the teaching that we're talking about, but how the mind works. And that is, when I was a child, I had a music box, which was a very simple melody, Waltz of the Flowers, by Tchaikovsky. Well, it's Christmas just passed, and a lot of people go to see the Nutcracker, and that's one of the pieces in the Nutcracker. And I was doing something or other at work, and I wanted some background music, and I found this teaching about music theory, and he happened to be using Tchaikovsky to make his points, which a couple of things. And then so this piece of music that I've heard way back when suddenly was just so clear and beautiful, and it's been going in my head up and on since. I am hearing it. It's not out there, it's in here. So it's the out there, in here thing I get a little confused about, on what is real, you know?
Is there a question there?
There is. That. How does that happening of the mind,
why does the mind do that?
Well, what is Tara more real if she's over here, wherever she is, versus in here? You know, what is real?
Well, I guess it depends upon you as to whether you take external reality to be more real than internal reality. I don't think that there's just one answer to that question.
Does that go into conviction as well?
Yeah, it does go into conviction. So I don't think Donald Trump believes anything that is real except what he can grab. So he believes in external reality. Yeah, okay, well, maybe that was a bad example for a variety of reasons. But unfortunately, I read the paper, and so he's always, you know. He's a materialist. And so for materialists, that which is material is real, and thoughts are not so real. Although, in that particular case, he's also a hedonist. So, you know, his internal sensations of a certain type are obviously very real and important to him. But I don't believe I don't think he's self-conscious enough that you could have this conversation with him. But were he self-conscious enough so you could have this conversation with him, I don't believe he would consider thoughts to be as real as things. There are other people who consider thoughts to be more real than things. Tchaikovsky, probably. Let's go to Beethoven. Beethoven probably believed music was more real than anything else, especially because he went deaf. Mm-hmm. And he could still somehow get music through vibration through his fingers, you know. I mean, like, the great composers, for them, the internal reality is more important. And it's not just the great composers. People have gone to their death over ideals. So the ideal was more important to them than the life of the body. I mean, one case comes to mind. This will sound a little bit strange, but for a long period of time, one of the things that I did for relaxation was I read about the naval history of the Second World War in the Pacific, of all odd things. But has something to do with growing up in, on the coast of California and being born in 1946 and a lot of other stuff. So there's a story of a submarine in the far western Pacific that was attacked on the surface of the water and was to be sunk, was going to be sunk. But because it was on the surface, people could get out of the ship. And one of the crew members, I don't think it was the captain, might have been the executive officer, might have been the captain, said, no, I'm going down with the submarine. The reason is I know too much about our plans for the upcoming invasion of whatever island it was. And if the Japanese capture me, they may torture me and I would give away that information and jeopardize the upcoming mission. So I'm going to die rather than do that. And he actually told members of the crew that's what he was doing because they said, come, there's time. And he said, no, I can't. And this is the reason why. This is a person who put ideals over his own life. So, you know, the answer can go either way. You know, what do you take to be the most real thing? For myself, I don't know. You'd have to put me to the test. I can't answer that question without the specific situation of, you know, what do I believe? Hard to say. Sometimes when I look at my bank account, I believe the external material reality is more important and real than anything else. And other times when I'm meditating and I kind of get blissed out doing Yamantaka, it's sort of like, who cares about the bank account? I mean, you know. So I'm kind of two minds. Yeah, Steve.
So you quoted His Holiness a little bit earlier, who said that the mind is in a different state of emptiness compared in highest yoga tantra compared to the three lower tantras. And it was a combination of bliss and emptiness. And that confuses me a little bit. And this is a theoretical question on my part, because I don't know. You said later that emptiness is the same, whatever the basic is based on the object, the emptiness has the same. Can there be a difference in the quality of the highest yoga tantra versus all of the other emptinesses on all of the other bases?
Yeah, I can answer that if I can stop coughing. He was talking about a mind realizing emptiness that was a very, very subtle mind, not an ordinary coarse mind realizing emptiness. So the emptiness of the mind in dreamless sleep, if you could understand, if the mind could understand the emptiness of the mind in dreamless sleep, is a subtler kind of emptiness than understanding, than the mind understanding the emptiness of dream images, which is subtler still than the mind sitting here in this room understanding the emptiness of a piece of paper. So he was being very specific. He was actually talking about the mind of clear light understanding its empty nature. The beatific mind of clear light understanding its empty nature, increasing its own beatific empty nature through that understanding. That's different than the coarse analytic mind we have when we think, now Nagarjuna said X, Y, and Z, and therefore I know that the appearance of the paper is different than the reality of the paper. And then I could perhaps actually sort of get an understanding of the emptiness of the paper. But that's the waking mind understanding the emptiness of something. It's not the subtlest mind understanding the emptiness of itself. Okay, so now the way to get into that experientially and get past the words, the way to get to that experientially is when you're meditating, I mean, I don't know what kind of meditation you do, but when you're meditating, when your body settles fully, so you're not kind of wiggling around and being distracted, you'll notice that your mind will calm down with whatever kind of practice you're doing. when your mind calmed down to that point, if you stop doing, just as an experiment, stop doing whatever practice you're doing and start paying attention to the mind or the consciousness, and as the thoughts arise, you notice that the thoughts have arisen and you don't get caught by them, so they don't drag you along. And there it is, that's a thought. The metaphor is like a cloud in the sky. You just sort of notice it and it will fade away. And as that process goes on, if you apply the emptiness logic, so part of your mind gets rational and applies the emptiness logic to the experiences that you're having of the thoughts fading away, you can start noticing the luminous nature of the mind. You've had that experience, right? Okay. If you pay attention to just that luminosity of awareness and dwell on that, just that luminosity of awareness, and then apply the emptiness logic to the luminosity, okay, that kind of scrapes away ideas about the luminosity, and the mere luminosity is there, that's beatific. You'll find that it's beatific. That's getting into a subtler quality of understanding emptiness. Now, if you can hold without being distracted, if you can hold attention on that beatific or blissful empty clarity luminosity, which is the natural nature of the mind, and not be distracted by thoughts or by your knees or anything else, and you just settle on that for a while, that's a placement meditation, okay? And that then will become subtler and subtler and subtler naturally. And the reason it'll become subtler and subtler naturally is because that's the natural nature of the mind, which is underlying all the distractions that are usually going on. And in that subtlety, if you keep the awareness of the empty nature of it, which is what's understanding the empty nature of it, this is why His Holiness said this thing about the, it's like this part of the mind becomes a part of the mind, whatever His language was, right? So then the subtler and subtler and subtler nature reveals itself quite naturally. It doesn't have to do anything because it's already there. It's just been obscured by the various thoughts and so on and so forth that are covering it up. So this is a removing of the obscurations. Immensely difficult, though.
So just to paraphrase very simply on my side, basically we're just revealing the innate nature of the mind without superimpositions or elaborations.
Yes, we are revealing the innate nature of the mind without any superimpositions or elaborations, which is already there, right? Because that's the mind that we have when we're in deep dreamless sleep. And we're just sort of settling into what's already there, consciously, rather than unconsciously.
Just from a practical perspective, there's an opportunity to do that type of meditation within every sadhana.
Yes.
If you have a commitment, then just in case, because I think sometimes people don't have to put it all together sometimes.
Right. There are points in every sadhana where you have the opportunity. Yes. To meditate on the nature of the mind. There's another way to get into it. Since you mentioned Vajrasattva, go ahead, Steve.
What? Oh, I was just asking if you had just given us a mini course on Mahamudra. So
except in Mahamudra, you actually do this practice on the basis of having arisen as the Yidam who's doing it. Yeah. So it's a little bit more complicated. And then, actually, first you practice generation stage, which is arising as the Edom. Then you practice completion stage, which is the actual ability to manipulate the energies. And on the basis of doing that, then you practice Mahamudra. So there's the mini course. But what I was going to say about Vajrasattva is that when you practice Vajrasattva, the way you, well, this is the way it is this is the way you practice Vajrasattva in the context of the Amantaka sadhana. So let me be very specific about it. You imagine Vajrasattva appearing on the crown of your head, your physical head. And then you imagine the external Vajrasattva, which is to say the Vajrasattva that comes out of the actual empty nature of the mind, merging with the Vajrasattva that's on the crown of your head. And then you imagine that goddess has come and consecrate the union of the two by pouring bliss, wisdom nectars and filling them up. And then you imagine lights going out to all sentient beings, including yourself, and the Buddhas and Bodhisattvas who have received the light then send light back in the form of blessing, right? And then you meditate on this effulgent white light coming out of the home at the Vajrasattva's heart, whether Vajrasattva with consort or not, this effulgent white light coming out, filling all the realms of space and also pouring down into you. If that isn't beatific, I don't know what is. Because what you've done is you've generated the wind energy that's associated with Vajrasattva, filling all the space, all of your neighbors, all of the world, if you can do that, and at the same time flowing down into you. And that bliss, I mean, they say that in the practice, the point of practicing with bliss is it concentrates the mind. So now you're doing a placement meditation on bliss, which is supported by the bliss that creates the placement meditation, which creates more bliss, which creates more placement meditation, while you're holding this image, which you have the conviction of understanding as Vajrasattva, because the bliss can get so intense that it naturally generates conviction that it's coming from someplace, and that's what it's coming from. Vajrasattva is your own mind, or Vajrasattva is outside of you. It doesn't really make any difference when you're in that state. It doesn't, because it's a beatific state. And when you're in a beatific state, your mind isn't asking questions like, is it inside or outside? It's just sort of like, yeah.
I feel like you gave us our aha moment, David.
Aha moment.
You brought it all back.
Okay, good, great. Good.